Blog Talk Radio.
Home Companion, the place where ideas are exchanged in open air just because we think that this is the way of the future of the principles of Freemasonry. Things being defined around us as we move at this rapidly wonderful pace through the 21st century. Hello, everyone. This is a special day, 12th of July, 2015. This is the 193rd day of the year, if you can believe that. We're moving toward the autumnal equinox. Where right now, where I am, summer has arrived in its fullness. We have Tour de France happening. We have the Pan Am Games going on around us. We have professional sports. If you're a fan of three down Canadian football, that's happening. And, you know, what's not to like? What is absolutely not to like? And if you're a gardener, it's brilliant out there. We have so much abundance here around us. And this is a shout out to all of the people out west who are struggling with the fires. We want you to know that you are in our thoughts, and we hope that this is resolved somehow. I know that there's been projections that this could continue on into September until the weather steps up and does helps out. But we certainly hope that the calamities are avoided, in that you and yours are together. Whatever struggle you need to go through, you do it together, and you know that the entire country is watching. And it does matter to everyone. That said, we have an interesting show today. We're going to talk a bit more about choices that Freemasonry gives everybody. I always like to think that this isn't like a discussion behind the walls of a lodge. That's different. This is more of, it's not quite recruitment, but it's encouragement. We want to talk about what it is. If you're going to join something, if you're going to participate fully in it, it really is important to be able to have an idea of what it is that's going on so that you can make meaningful, qualified choices. And we see that as the life expectancy of a Mason goes on, some of his interests and attitudes about the order, just like life, begin to change, begin to mature. And so if you were to ask somebody at different points in their if we could magically ask somebody that's been at the order, just thinking about it, knocking at the door, wondering whether you're a boy or a girl, there are a man or a woman, there are opportunities within Freemasonry. And the distinction, as you know, is considered irregular. Even then, I'm hard pressed to know how to address this whole question of regular and legitimate, or in the existential sense, these things are part of the lexicon. They're part of us. They're going on around us. And I think it's curious and interesting to think that in the general public, it doesn't necessarily distinguish between branches and orders the way that members of the craft may. The craft isn't losing a step. The craft being transformed. I have a question for you, of course, as I do for all of the shows. You and I have talked about how Freemasonry is sort of a product of the times. It's a product of philosophical development, a product of the leisure class in a way. You can't do this, and this is for a thoughtful man. Not necessarily, when I think about it, it's not necessarily, because you can be working in agriculture, you can be a farmer or a herdsman, and still be very active and engaging Freemason. The Constitution, the development of what I think is the cultural legitimacy of the order, did that change Freemasonry? Excuse me, I'm on the verge of coughing here. did that change Freemasonry? If not that, as it expanded well beyond the small group that started, I think of Noah's Ark, it started with a small group. If it ever did exist, it can in our mind, in our imagination. Did the fact that we grew so large, and did that change the nature of the need for some kind of structural linkage, some kind of order, where we had representatives having to be active in communicating with different branches and different lodges? Did that change the nature of Freemasonry? Did or was it establishment of uniformity of ritual, did that essentially change Freemasonry? And if you think through, it's not clear. Excuse me. It's not clear that, at least not in my mind, that these events fundamentally changed the order. Nor should we think that the change, or any changes that have occurred, have come to a stop. Freemasonry has never been, nobody's declared that it's frozen in time, have they? Nor would they. No thoughtful in trying to preserve something. If that's the effort, then what we're doing, in a sense, seems to be to morning wake up after being ill and having this ruthless dry cough. Excuse me, gentlemen and guests. Nobody's to say that this snapshot that we're trying to preserve is going to interrupt the flow and evolution of the craft. Nobody ever declares that. The notion that we've always done things a certain way is remarkable, because what we've always done is evolve. We have always been flexible enough to change to meet the requirements of cultural and events. Even the language has changed. The meaning of the words that we use today and the kind of language, you know, we are adding and taking away words in the dictionary every single year. Well, the meaning of those words also changes. So we've always tried. Oh, dear me. We've always needed to be have some relevancy, and language is really key to that, isn't it? Important to help us understand. So if we're taking a 15th century document out of context and reading it in the mindset of 21st century, we're missing something. Clearly we're missing something. Same with, if you move that forward to 17th century, 17th century works are going to be lacking unless we can put it into context. So it's always important. But that's a thinking man's approach to this. So have we attempted to freeze something that can't be frozen? I ask that seriously. Can that snapshot that we have, that we're going to preserve, does that snapshot necessary? Is it representative? And in your mind, can we preserve that moving forward? When in fact, if we've never done it this way, if we're still thinking that we need to continue to do what we're doing the way it has been done, well, we're in for some pretty serious and interesting challenges and change. And that is, if you're a student of history, I think we can see that there have been things that are similar through time. That snapshot, time, you know, is sort of the appetizer for history, I think. But we need to ask ourselves, and I'll ask you, the think tank out there, can this be accomplished? If you're thinking that we can create, we have some creation, we have a notion of what we're going to preserve in its fullness, and that we can preserve that moving forward, is that possible? just a symptom of delight here today on radio. Excuse me. I love getting this age. Anyway, I'll leave that with you as we move forward. We'll leave that with you as we move forward, and keep that in the back of your mind today, okay? even the topic matter here, the topic line today is gaining on the enigmatic practice of Freemasonry. There was once a time when Freemasonry, so say I, was fluid, a counterbalance of superstition and the suppression of ideas. Now, this topic will have to be brilliant to overcome me sneezing and coughing and carrying on, and still catch your attention. Freemasonry was fluid, a counterbalance of superstition and the suppression of ideas. It was a balance. The avant-garde, I'm thinking the suppression of ideas. Avant-garde always faces that, that always performs that function in our society. Only when we were able to gain distance and time and space from the events of the 16th, 17th, and 18th century were we able to calculate the effects of shifts in social acceptance. It's like anything, you know, at the time, can you tell what's going on around us? Well, no, we look at it in hindsight, and that's where we learn. That's how we learn. That's often how we learn, or not. Magna Carta, Renaissance, Age of Enlightenment, War of the Roses, the Battle of Waterloo. In hindsight, great minds were able to help us comprehend why history is so important to a culture. Now, we've talked here about those times before history was, in a sense, invented. It didn't always exist. It was created or described or defined, I think. Perspective allows us to sort out major events, though at the time of them, few are known to be so. Few can tell. Is there a major event going on today? Well, who can tell? If we're to press for an answer, it's essentially an opinion. It's fun. Offer your opinion. It's, you know, conjecture. Perhaps there are exceptions to the rule. Certainly when Germans were eradicating one culture and the Americans were incinerating another, convinced many of us there is no extent of human cruelty. Nothing, including evil, is out of bounds in a righteous cause. Now, are those countries the same as they were? No. Great nations, great ideas. But now we have a new level of inhumanity. After reading the work of Andrew Hammer, I was taken back by the extent we are from the fluid counterbalances of our early days. Does mankind continue to struggle? Yes, of course. Does it struggle to use the moral meridian? Yes, I think more than ever. The accumulated knowledge matters little unless it is put to use as it was intended in the day. Universal laws bind us, but it is the purity of philosophy that translate principles into decisions that define us. Brother Hammer tells us to avoid the allure and distractions around us, suggesting that what we seek in those appendant groups can be found within the walls of the lodge. Are we so tribal, as this implies, that joining appendant groups must confuse us about what version of Masonry it is that drives us? Is this a Masonic secularity? Once we were content celebrating sun and moon. Then we celebrated representative gods. Then the creator and philosophy addressed how to live a good life. Then we quarreled about the best creator. And then blasphemy was born. Gaining on the enigmatic practice of Freemasonry. It's a choice. How you practice your version of Freemasonry is a choice. But it's a choice based on some landmarks. Now, the landmarks are there, whether they're defined by a particular constitution or not. They're like signposts, the bifurcation signs, to help us to navigate. Yeah. So we have choices, don't we? All of them valid in their own way. But when you make that choice about the form of Masonry that is intriguing and appealing to you, that in itself doesn't define Freemasonry. Does a person, when they make that choice, commit themselves? Is Freemasonry a calling or a meeting? Is it a social opportunity? The calling, the group that feels that it's a calling, probably have questions at a deeper level that they need answered. And they don't always parade those deeper answers around because essentially other men will begin to mock them. We know this. Until they get into the company of other like-minded individuals where that conversation becomes lively and becomes uninhibited and it thrives, it begins to allow these minds to challenge, hear the challenge, and learn, to have their ideas pressed. That's wonderful, a wonderful mixture, and it's great for the conversation. Great for ideas. The ideas are valid, they'll stand these tests. If not, then we can re-examine whether the ideas had merit and whether we need to look for a different variation on them. So Freemasonry is a lot like that when it comes to choice. Then we actually begin to measure by our own barometer the commitment that we make, the work that we're prepared to do. And I don't know if it's just the bumper sticker, you get out of it what you put into it. Well, these are sort of, I don't think they're meant to be glib. It's like mea culpa. Is that glib? Well, you know, there's something to it. So it's like in anything in life, the opportunities we create by being vigilant, by being earnest and forthright in our efforts and in our actions. To be a well-rounded individual, which I hope is your part of the choice that we're making collectively here, means that we're going to look at how we're going to function in relation to other people at large. We don't walk down the street with a small banner across our breast saying that I espouse the philosophies of Freemasonry. If we did that, then people would perhaps stop us and say, well, what are those philosophies? And that would perhaps mean that we have to think this through before we would attempt that. Better, in a sense, to operate as a gentleman. With, if nothing else, Freemasonry teaches us to function by embracing the notion of leadership that is humble. In fact, we define true leadership is an act of humility. Though this isn't the peacocks, this isn't the puffin stuff, the person that likes to hear themselves speak. This isn't. This is the person that that asks himself or herself, what essentially have they learned on this day? What has life, what has other people taught them about themselves? The Mason will be exhibiting insights. And part of that insight that we are influenced to consider is that life of self-satisfaction within the limits and boundaries of what they have. A person that has that sense of what the world seems to struggle for, contentment. Now, does Masonry generate contentment? Well, yes, it does. Unfortunately, I think a lot of very, very lovely men and lovely members haven't had the opportunity to talk about that idea, to be able, and it's happening, so that it's just waiting for somebody to bring that out. And I think that's a bit of a, I think that's a bit of a shame that it's there, and it needs to be, you know, if it's on your Masonic bucket list, check it off. It doesn't happen because you, we say it does. This is something that is an after the fact. This is like learning about confidence. Confidence isn't something that comes from inside a person. A person is always trying and struggling to do their best, never with that sense that they have all the answers. So they're always watching it and a bit nervous in a way that they've missed something. So there's an urgency and an energy to that person. When other people, it's other people that define us as being confident. We may walk around with this, you know, the self-help books will tell us, oh, well, if you have this mindset, then you can become this. Well, you know, lovely. Except the self-help books come and go, don't they? Where are the pop magazines, pop psychology of 1983? Well, they've been shredded. This is stuff that comes from inside of us, and it's defined, as we all are, not only by our own worldview or own view of ourselves, but from the view of other people around us that can see us in a way that we can't possibly see ourselves. Think of it like that, a blind spot that we have. Everybody has blind spots, we know this, but in terms of personality and character, we also have blind spots. So what we do, it isn't barbarous. It's like take away history, takes away valence. It's neither positive or negative. It is prone to manipulation. Oh my goodness, yes. But history stands alone. If we look at it unvarnished, it teaches us a great deal about ourselves. The task for us is to overcome that meager sense of neuroses, where everything that is seemed inconsistent with our worldview is considered negative and therefore bad, because it's, after all, criticizing us. We're imperfect. Well, after a certain age of childhood, we should be able to get over that ego, should we? But if the comments and thoughts are said in a cruel and demeaning way, of course that stings a bit. But then it doesn't necessarily mean that insight stops. It means that if we find people around us that are insensitive, that enables us to define them. People's actions define them as people, just like you and I do. So the fellow that is most critical, most all-knowing, and most omnipotent, if you think about it, if he is off-putting, if he's harsh toward other people, he is tenfold the same with himself. You don't just have that kind of decaying, eroding mindset toward the external world. It also drags in their own. What we're seeing is a reflection of that person's internalized sense of who they are. And so we can see the pathos. It's sad when somebody is trapped and has that kind of needs and looks for that kind of tension and debate everywhere they are. That, my brethren, is a lonely individual, lonely in their own thoughts, lonely in their own being. So come back to with me to, you know, the little tricks that Montaigne offered us. I want to talk to you about that art of living, because I do and think it's important for us to talk about the benefits that those choices that we make All of those roads lead to Rome. About academic philosophers. This is from, 14th century? Early 16th century. Michel Equiem de Montaigne. Do you remember? 1533 to 1592, and if an influence, because he did this material, put down this material, and the ideas hadn't been displayed this way. He was talking about himself, but he was conveying a message for everybody about his life. About academic philosophers, Montaigne was usually dismissive. He disliked their pedantries and abstractions, but he showed an endless fascination for another tradition in philosophy. And I think this accounts for a lot of us. The other tradition is that of the great pragmatic schools, Pythagoras, which explored such questions as how to cope with a friend's death, how to work up courage, how to act well in morally difficult situations, and how to make the most of life. These were the philosophies he turned to in times of grief or fear, as well as for guidance in dealing with more minor everyday irritations. The three most famous such systems of thought were Stoicism, Epicureanism, and Skepticism. The philosophies collectively known as Hellenistic because they had their origins in the era when Greek thought and culture spread to Rome and other Mediterranean regions from the 3rd century BC onward. They differed in details, but were so close in essentials as to be hard to distinguish much at the time. Like everyone else, Montaigne mixed and matched them according to his needs. All of the schools had the same aim, to achieve a way of living known in the original Greek as eudaimonia, often translated as happiness or joy or human flourishing. Gentlemen, I think this is the meaning of the word happiness, which is the quest of Freemasonry, the goal of Freemasonry. This in itself, a way of living known and translated from the Greek as happiness or joy or human flourishing. This meant living well in every sense, thriving, relishing life, being a good person. They also agreed that the best path to eudaimonia was ataraxia, which might be rendered as imperturbability. So you're imperturbable, or freedom from anxiety, imperturbed, can't be perturbed. Ataraxia means equilibrium, the art of maintaining an even keel so that you neither exalt when things go well nor plunge into despair when they go awry. To attain it is to have control over your emotions, so that you are not battered and dragged about like them, like a bone fought over by a pack of dogs. Curious man. It is on the question of how we acquire such equanimity that the philosophies begin to diverge. How? Each had a different idea, for example, of how far one should compromise with the real world. The original Epicurean community, founded by Epicurus in the 4th century BC, required followers to leave their families and live like cult members in a private garden. Skeptics preferred to remain amid the public hurly-burly like everyone else, but with a radically altered mental state. Stoics were somewhere in between. The two best-known Stoic writers, Seneca and Epictetus, wrote for an elite Roman readership who were deeply involved in the affairs of their time and had no time for gardens. but who desired an oasis of tranquility and self-possession wherever they could find them. Stoics and Epicureans shared a great deal of their theory, too. They thought that the ability to enjoy life is thwarted by two big weaknesses: the lack of control over emotions and a tendency to pay too little attention to the present. If one could only get these two things right, controlling and paying attention, most other problems would take care of themselves. Remember, control over emotion and a tendency to pay too little attention to the present. Be in the moment. The artists out there that listen to the show will know this intuitively. Being in the moment, the now. The catch is that both are almost impossible to do. So difficult are they that one cannot approach them head on. It is necessary to sidle in from lateral angles and trick oneself into achieving them. Accordingly, Stoic and Epicurean thinkers spent much time devising techniques and thought experiments. For example, a little takeaway. Imagine that today is the last day of your life. Are you ready to face death? Imagine even when this very moment now is the last moment of your existence. What are you feeling? Do you have regrets? Are there things you wish you had done differently? Are you really alive at this instant? Or are you consumed with panic, denial, and remorse? This experiment opens your eyes to what is important to you and reminds you of how time turns and runs constantly through your fingers. Some Stoics even acted out this last moment experiments with props and a supporting cast. Seneca wrote of a wealthy man named Pacuvius who conducted a full-scale funeral ceremony for himself every day, ending with a feast after which he would have himself carried from the table to his bed on a bier with all the guests and servants in tow. He has lived his life. He has lived his life. You could achieve the same effect more simply and cheaply by just holding the idea of your own demise in your mind and paying full attention to it. The Epicurean writer Lucretius suggests picturing yourself at the point of death and considering two possibilities. Either you have lived well, in which case you can go your way satisfied, like a well-fed guest leaving a party, or you have not. But then it makes no difference that you are losing your life, since you obviously did not know what to do with it anyway. This may offer scant comfort on your deathbed, but if you think about it in the midst of life, it helps you to change your perspective. Such shifts in attitude are the purpose of many of the thought experiments. If you have lost somebody or something precious, you can try to value them differently by imagining that you never knew that person or never owned that object. How can you miss what you never had? A different angle produces a different emotion. Plutarch suggests such a ploy in a letter to his wife after their two-year-old daughter died. He advised her to think back to before the girl was born and pretend that they were back in those days again. Whether this consoled her or not isn't known, but at least it gave her something to focus on instead of swimming in the ocean of undifferentiated grief. Montaigne and his friend Le Boetier both knew this letter well, for Le Boetier translated it into French and Montaigne edited his translation for publication. It may have come into Montaigne's mind each time one of his own children died, as well as when he lost his friend La Boetie. The friendship had been so short that it should not have been difficult to remember a time before it and recapture his pre-La Boetie nonchalance. Think, these two men had a meeting of the minds, and they found the same subtle thinking, the same values, the same view of the world, great deal of compatibility, and it formed a very rapid and intense and wonderful friendship. And then the fellow died. The key to cultivate mindfulness are proshots, another Greek term. Mindful attention is the trick that underlies many of the other tricks. It is a call to attend to the inner world and thus also to the outer world, for uncontrolled emotion blurs reality as tears blur a view. Anyone who clears their vision and lives in full awareness of the world as it is, Seneca says, can never be bored with life. A person who does not sleepwalk through the world, moreover, is free to respond to situations in the right way without hesitation, as if there were questions asked all of a sudden, as Epictetus puts it. A violent attack, a quarrel, the loss of a friend, all of these demands barked at you by life, as by a school teacher trying to catch you not paying attention in class. Even a moment of boredom is such a question. Whatever happens, however foreseen it is, you should be able to respond in a precisely suitable way. That is why, for Montaigne, learning to live appropriately is the great and glorious masterpiece of human life. Now, is this a product of Freemasonry? Stoics and Epicureans alike approach this goal mainly through rehearsal and meditation, like tennis players practicing volleys and smashes for hours. They used rehearsal to carve grooves of habit down which their minds would run as naturally as water down a riverbed. It is a form of self-hypnotism. The great Stoic Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius kept notebooks in which he would go over the changes of perspective he wished to drill into himself. Here's a little one. Here's an example. How good it is when you have roast meat or such like foods before you to impress on your mind that this is the dead body of a fish, the dead body of a bird or pig, and again that the Falernian wine is the mere juice of grapes and your purple-edged robe simply the hair of a sheep soaked in shellfish blood. And in sexual intercourse, that it is no more than the friction of a membrane and the spurt of mucus ejected. At other times, he imagined flying up to the heavens so that he could gaze down and see how insignificant all human concerns were from such a distance. Seneca did this too. Place before your mind's eyes the vast spread of time's abyss and consider the universe, and then contrast our so-called human life with infinity. Another practice of the Stoics was to visualize time circling around on itself over aeons. Thus, Socrates would be born again and would teach in Athens just as he did the first time. Every butterfly would flap its wings in the same way. Every cloud would pass overhead at the same speed. You yourself would live again and have all the same thoughts and emotions as before, again and again without end. This apparently terrifying idea brought comfort because, like the other ideas, it showed one's own fleeting troubles at a reduced size. at the same time, because everything you had ever done would come back to haunt you, everything mattered. Nothing was flushed away. Nothing could be forgotten. Meditating on this forced you to pay more attention to how you lived your everyday life. It posed a challenge, and it led a kind of acceptance to what the Stoics called amor fati, or love of fate. As the Stoic Epictetus wrote, "Do not seek to have everything that happens happen as you wish, but wish for everything to happen as it actually does happen, and your life will be serene." That's, I think, a reasonable message that I would like to leave you with. And I'd like you to just dwell for a moment, to think for a moment, on whether that can be or should be, or in fact is, a way of achieving the good life that is promised by Freemasonry within the grasp of each and every person out there that has a sense of the imagination to help them answer the questions that logic and rational thought cannot, and has that desire to improve. Life is serious, so it's important to gain control of our emotion, as we hear, and to pay attention, be in the moment. So be in this moment. Let me draw you in right now, where there's balance around us. Remember, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. That goal, that self-fulfillment that we seek is beyond the point where we can be perplexed. A sorrow's crown is just remembering happier times. These are quotes of Alfred Lord Tennyson. A broad smile is often a scowl at home, he says. Complicated man. Words, like nature, half reveal and half conceal the soul within. It's like saying, who truly knows themselves? Well, the man who is observant, who is evaluating, who is wise in love, loves love most, say least. But here, guard your roving thoughts with a jealous care, for speech is but the dialer of thoughts, and every fool can plainly read in your words what is the hour of your thoughts. Theirs is not to make reply. Theirs is not to reason why. Theirs is but to do and die. Us. Enjoy the rest of the week. May the great architect of the universe cradle you in hands that are protective and encouraging, and help you to answer the important questions. A little bit of music, Canadiana, these days. I'm going to start with Stan Rogers, and then we'll have a little Natalie McMaster, and then La Boutine de Sorette from Quebec. Enjoy, and thank you for tuning in, Masonic Home Companion. I look forward to being with you again next week. Cheers.
Oh, the year was 1778. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. A letter of mark came from the king to the scummiest vessel I've ever seen. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Oh, well, said Barrett, parade the town. How I wish I was out in Sherbrooke now. For 20 brave men, all fishermen, who would make for him the antelope's crew? God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. The antelope sloop was a sickening sight. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. She'd a list to the port and her sails in rags, and the cook in the scuppers with the staggers and jags. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. On the king's birthday we put to sea. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. We were 91 days to Montego Bay, pumping like madmen all the way. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. On the 96th day we sailed again. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. When a bloody great Yankee hove in sight, with our cracked four-pounders we made to fight. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. The Yankee lay low down with gold. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. She was broad and fat and loose in stays, but the catcher took the antelope 2 whole days. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Then at length we stood 2 cables away. I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Our cracked four-pounders made an awful din, but with 1 fat ball the Yanks stove us in. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. The antelope shook and pitched on her side. I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Barrett was smashed like a bowl of eggs, and the main truck carried off both men eggs. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. So here I lay in the 23rd year. I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. It's been 6 years since we sailed away, and I just made Halifax yesterday. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's
to just quickly start out with a little bit of music here. Thank you. Thank you. Play one together now. We're laughing because our styles are totally different, as you can hear. And so, Janelle and I are actually in the process of writing new pieces of music together that we can play, but we don't have any of those ready. We just started yesterday. So we're going to play something together anyway. With 1 minute.
They're running late downstairs. We've got another 10 minutes.
We're going to play a tune, and Natalie's going to accompany me on the piano. The Cape Breton piano playing is just awesome. It's very rhythmic, and it's you'll see it. My mom plays piano, and she learned to play the before they had a piano at home at in Cape Breton, before Mom's family had a piano in Cape Breton, she learned to play the rhythms on a piece of board, and the fiddlers would all congregate to play on the cold winter's evenings, and Mom would be banging on this board. So when they bought a piano, they bought it in Toronto and had it taken by a train and brought in on a horse and sleigh to the house. It became the only piano in the region, and Mom said she could basically play, as soon as the piano arrived, she could play it because she had learned all these rhythms. Anyway, we found the piano last year and were able to bring it back home. We purchased it. It had gone through like five or six families, and it was just a big thing for us. And we found actually an old picture of somebody in their family years ago. Anyway, I'm blabbering on here. What about Leahy? She wants to talk about. We have a band named Leahy. There's 11 siblings. We what will I tell them? We had a great opportunity. We opened for Shania Twain for 2 years on her international tour. It was a big thing for us, and now all my sisters are off having babies, and the boys are all getting married. So we're staying close to home for I guess another couple of weeks. What can I say? I don't know what to say, Natalie.
Is this what marriage is about? I like it.
Oh, yeah, okay. In our family, we had 7 girls, 4 boys. We had 2 fiddles and 1 piano. And, of course, we were all fighting to play on the instruments. So Dad and Mom set a rule that you couldn't kick anyone off the instrument. You had to wait till they were finished. So, of course, what we'd do is we'd get on the piano and you wouldn't even get off to eat because you wouldn't want to give it up to your brother or sister. And they'd wait and wait and wait. And it'd be midnight and you'd be still sitting there on the piano. But it was their way to get us to practice. Will we play a tune? It works. Okay, sorry. I hate to see our analogy. So this is our last number, and we'll feature Nat and piano.
Okay, it's Port à la Fontaine, pour y pêcher du poisson, la gigazon, zinzon.
Port à la Fontaine, pour y pêcher du poisson, la gigazon, zinzon.
La fontaine est profonde, je me suis coulé à fond, la gigazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis le pire, puis le pam, 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 pam aussi, il a bassin, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
La fontaine est profonde, je me suis coulé à fond, la gigazon, zinzon.
La fontaine est profonde, je me suis coulé à fond, la gigazon, zinzon.
Par ici, c'est lui passe, mon cavalier baron, la gigazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis a pis a pis a femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Ah, c'était lui pas, trois cavaliers barons, la gigazon, zinzon.
Ah, c'était lui pas, trois cavaliers barons, la gigazon, zinzon.
Que me donne les nouvelles, si vous tirez du fond, la gigazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis a pis a pis a femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Que vous donneriez-vous belle si vous tirez du fond la digazon, zinzon.
Que vous donneriez-vous belle si vous tirez du fond la digazon, zinzon.
Tirez, tirez, dit-elle, après ça nous verrons la digazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis à pied, puis à femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Tirez, tirez, dit-elle, après ça nous verrons la tigazon, zinzon.
Tirez, tirez, dit-elle, après ça nous verrons la tigazon, zinzon.
Quand ta belle fille t'appelle, ça sauve à la maison la tigazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis à pied, puis à femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Quand la belle fuit à terre, ça sauve à la maison, la tigazon, zinzon.
Quand la belle fuit à terre, ça sauve à la maison, la tigazon, zinzon.
S'assoit à la fenêtre, compose une chanson, la tigazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis à pied, puis à femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Ça soit à la fenêtre, compose une chanson, la digazon, zinzon.
Ça soit à la fenêtre, compose une chanson, la digazon, zinzon.
Mon petit cœur en garde, n'est pas pour les barons, la digazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis à pied, puis à femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Mon petit cœur en gave, n'est pas pour un baron, la digazon, zinzon.
Mon petit cœur en gave, n'est pas pour un baron, la digazon, zinzon.
Mais pour un homme de guerre, qui a du poil au menton, la digazon, zinzon.
Puis en haut, puis en bas, puis à pied, puis à femme, 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 femme aussi, puis la bottine, tin, tin, rigolait, ha, ha.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.
Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, tout rouillé. Son petit porte-clé, tout rouillé, gaiement.